You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
It is Wednesday, January 24th, 2018. My name is Michael Brooks on a hybrid Michael and Sam Majority Report Wednesday. We are broadcasting live, and this is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We're broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On today's program, The Intercept's James Risen on his time at the New York Times dealing with the Obama administration, the Bush administration, potentially unofficial censorship, covering the war on terror, decision makings by the editorial of the New York Times. It's pretty disturbing blockbuster stuff on covering that role, that world, and U.S. foreign policy and the New York Times relationship to it. Brand new interview Sam just recorded. And Donald Trump has a request for the next 3 weeks. Keep him the hell away from Chuck Schumer. Total bad guy. Remember that report on how border agents were pouring out bottles of water that were placed there to help people crossing the border not die of thirst or get severely dehydrated, and they poured it out? Well, the activists that exposed that little crime against humanity, they've been arrested. We'll get to that. Donald Trump is defending the quote-unquote America First agenda before heading to Davos, where the globe's elite are meeting. And gunmen storm a Save the Children aid office in Afghanistan. I think ISIS has taken credit for this. More than half of America sees Trump as biased against black people. Where did that come from? That's totally unfair. I'm the least racist person who's ever been polled on how racist they are. And there's been a school shooting in Kentucky, making it the nation's 11th of the year. And we're only into the 24th day of the first month. All that and much, much more on today's Majority Report. Let's start. We've been talking about the Democratic cave. They failed on both metrics. Not strategic, not ruthless, not effective, and of course, with no sort of moral urgency for saving Dreamers and the broader sort of case for the human rights of immigrants. This clip, where actually Rachel Maddow's asking him some decent questions, and we're going to just see the just sort of, I mean, watching Chuck Schumer lay out what the play is here, like Ezra Klein's failed spin on this, or just sort of dorkish reading of it, is a lot more convincing in bullet point form than actually watching Chuck Schumer present this. I mean, this is just embarrassing. Far better to say, look, we're not shutting the government down. This isn't happening right now. We're going to save it for a future battle. We're going to get chipped. Don't even worry about it. We don't have the votes. To go through this exercise, cave immediately, expose your weaknesses and lack of cohesion, and then basically come out with like a, we have a chip from Mitch McConnell is, I mean, wow. I think, in fact, I mean, it's quite clear to me that, again, regardless of policy stances, Harry Reid was a lot more effective at this job in both minority and majority than Chuck Schumer. Here he is, just as Democrats put this together.
If they don't do it by March 5th, the awful, awful, awful pictures of Dreamers being deported, I think will rally the nation and the House will be forced to do it. Pause. So this was what we thought.
I'm sorry. The House of Representatives, dominated by Republicans in districts with virulent anti-immigrant sentiment, will be forced to do it because there will be protests in Washington because of, quote, mainstream, lamestream media coverage of people being deported. Now, We've already got families being exposing the travesty of this administration's immigration policies on The View. And you couldn't even stay through a shutdown. And now you think that the Republican House is going to be forced to back down on this? I mean, look, there's a fine line between willing things into reality and just being delusional, sounding like you're huffing glue outside of Penn Station. And I think we know where Chuck Schumer is in this part of it.
Was the best shot we had. You know, when Trump shut the government down and we wouldn't go along, it's the first time Democrats did it, and we did it for Dreamers because we care. But we have to use the few tools we have to get the best result.
On Sunday night, you turned down the chance to vote for the CR, the funding of the government, without the things that you were standing up for, with the kind of strategy that you're describing here. But then the following day, yesterday, you took that same deal that you had turned down the night before. Now, I hear what you're saying in terms of what power that you had, but that can't have been the plan, to stand up for it for a few days and then ultimately vote for what you previously said.
Rachel, we didn't have the offer until late Sunday night. Susan Collins, who's been a very good person on this, came to my office. I said, the promise McConnell made, the vague promise as of Sunday, isn't enough. We need him to commit that A, we would get a vote on a clean bill. B, that it would be a vote that of a bill that I okayed, so it couldn't be a fake bill or a bill filled with lots of poison pills, and that it would come to the floor at a specific time, the week of February 8th. Is there a guarantee that McConnell keeps his word? No. But we're going to hold his feet to the fire, and everyone in your audience who cares about Dreamers should focus on McConnell. That's what we all agreed to today. We had a very good meeting. There was a lot of upsetness in the room, of course. Not at us, really, but because the Dreamers haven't gotten what they need and the time is ticking. But everyone agreed that the focus should be on McConnell and the Republican senators. Democrats are all for Dreamers. And to get in a circular firing squad and shoot at Democrats when we don't have the power and we have to use the limited power we have in as strategic a way as we can, that's what makes sense, focusing on the Republicans.
Yeah, the trouble is that you weren't strategic. And the trouble is that everybody who negotiated this deal clearly does not support the Dreamers 100%. They caved, they undermined your authority, and stripped away both your strategy and exposed your weaknesses. Now, at the same time that interview was taking place, there was actually audio found of a meeting going on in Mitch McConnell's office. And it went something like this. Hey, guys, Chuck Schumer is going to threaten me. He's going to hold my feet to the fire. Ooh.
Nice.
I'm terrified, absolutely. Whoa, feeling a little heat down there. That's as hot as a opium pipe in one of my in-laws' dens in Taiwan.
Take my slippers off.
Yeah.
I don't know. I heard that he did a pinky promise with no take-backs this time, which, as we all know, is legally binding.
He's got me dead to rights.
Got me dead to rights. Yep, crossed my toes. The old loophole. I wrote not in the margins of our written agreement. Jesus.
Dope.
Dope, Rachel, there was only so much we could do. Don't criticize us. Certainly don't think about why you have a totally sclerotic leadership with no new lifeblood in it for generations doing the same failed strategy. You wouldn't want to do that. Fire Ron McConnell. Focus on him. And look, absolutely. Call Republican senators. I'm not even going to say shame them. They're completely beyond shame. But of course, the heat and the energy of politics should be primarily focused on the Republican Party. They run everything. But we can't just have cohesion with Democrats if, setting aside serious policy differences, they don't even know what they're doing. Each new year, 30% of people make the resolution to be more financially responsible. Most of these people don't follow through. Being responsible is hard. Matt.
Agreed.
Policy Genius is an easy way to compare and buy life insurance online. They let you compare quotes in just 5 minutes. It's almost unheard of to make a responsible purchase in 5 minutes. Policy Genius has helped over 4 million people shop for insurance, and they've placed over $20 billion in coverage. And they don't just insure life. They insure everything in it. You can compare health insurance, disability insurance, pet insurance, renter's insurance. So many ways to be responsible. So if you made your New Year's resolution to be better with money, achieve it at policygenius.com. It's an easy way to compare life insurance, to buy life insurance. It's an easy way to compare and buy life insurance. There's zero sales pressure and no hassle. And it's free. It's free is the most financially responsible price. Policy Genius. Get your New Year's resolution resolved in 5 minutes. Policygenius.com. We're going to go. This is an interview that Sam recorded a few days ago with James Risen. And we will get to it in about 30 seconds. And then we'll be back on the flip side.
We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. James Risen, the Pulitzer Prize winning, now with the senior national security national security correspondent at The Intercept, also author of numerous best-selling books, including State of War, The Secret History of the CIA and the Bush Administration, which in some respects, your piece in The Intercept, My Life as a New York Times Reporter in the Shadow of War on Terror, is almost in some ways a backstory of the reporting that went into State of War. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So, I mean, let's start with, I guess, the one of those things that one of the stories that was in State of War, which ultimately was published in the New York Times. But let's start with the discovery of Stellar Wind. Remind folks what Stellar Wind is and how you began to report on it.
Yeah, Stellar Wind is the code name for the NSA's domestic spying program that began after 9/11 and which continues today. It's the same broad program that Edward Snowden released documents about, it's kind of the umbrella term for very broad based surveillance of both metadata, which means, you know, phone call logs and email addresses, and content, voice communications on phone or communications or the actual substance of emails and other data. And, you know, that program, as I said, began right after 9/11 and was secret. Its existence was the biggest, what a lot of people thought was the biggest secret in the government. And in 2004, I was covering the intelligence community for the New York Times, and a source in the course of a conversation, a source told me, I know the biggest secret in the government, but I'm too afraid to tell you. And I decided to just keep meeting with that person over the next few months. And the two of us began to just talk about how this thing that was the biggest secret that the source couldn't tell me. And finally, in late summer, I guess it was, of 2004, I just said to the source, you've got to tell me now, what is this that we keep talking about? And then the source, you know, kind of told me over a short period of time, outlined the whole structure of this domestic spying operation that nobody knew it existed. And that was the beginning of my reporting on it, and then it led to this very, very long negotiations between the New York Times and the government over whether to publish the story.
And I want to talk about those negotiations, and in some ways they led to the outcome of those negotiations led to the State of War, the book.
Yeah.
But let me ask you this. Like, what, I mean, I presume And tell me if I'm wrong, that your source shared this information with you because of their concern of the legality of this.
Yeah. There were a lot of. It turned out we found other people subsequently to talk to about it, and they were all very. They believed that it was either illegal or unconstitutional, and that it was being done secretly and without. Only a handful of people in the government knew, and most people in Congress were kept in the dark about it. And it was going. The key to the story was that they were skirting the law. They were going around the secret court that had been set up to handle, national security wiretaps and.
This is the
surveillance.
This is the FISA court.
The
Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act.
Surveillance Act.
I guess came out of in the 70s. That came out of I think it was the Church Commission. How many people did you have a sense of how many people knew this? I mean, as you started to do the reporting to get sort of confirmation from other sources, did you have a sense of how many mm-hmm. people knew this secret, and how many of them were concerned about its legality or constitutionality, and what differentiated them from those who would order it?
Well, over time, we came to realize that a lot of people in the government knew about it, in the very highest reaches of the government. And it turned out much later, found out that there'd been a rebellion at the Justice Department and the FBI over certain aspects of the program. And, all of this was being kept secret. And, to make sure that the Bush administration didn't suffer any political damage from it. And we eventually found out that one reason they were keeping it secret was that there were people at the highest reaches of the Bush administration who were afraid of being prosecuted if it all came out. It was a real conspiracy of silence.
And that extended in one fashion or another to the New York Times leadership. At what point did you go to the Times and say, "Hey, I have a big story here," and tell us what happened at that point?
Well, when you have a good story, you kind of tell editors pretty much immediately that you think you have a good story. Even if it's not ready to go. And all along I had been telling editors, there's something here that I think might be big. And then I started working with another reporter in the Washington Bureau on it, who was sitting next to me, and we realized that we were both hearing about the same thing from different people. And we started working together on a draft of a story. And then I think it was in the fall of 2004, I decided to call the NSA and kind of confront them and go through the front door to confront them. And I got Mike Hayden, the NSA director, on the phone and kind of read him the first couple drafts of a draft of a story. And he just gasped audibly and then, said, "Oh, whatever we're doing is legal and effective and, is operationally effective." And then he got off the phone. And before long, he called the Washington Bureau chief of the New York Times. And that kind of began a very long process of negotiations.
And presumably, where were you in the reporting at that point? I mean, did you feel like we've gone as far as we can go? Did you feel at that time, did you have a sense from your editors at the Times that, okay, this is about, we're going to run with this story? Because we're now talking, we're just before the 2004 election between Kerry and Bush. And this would have been right. rather important information to know when you go to the voting booth, or theoretically, right?
Right. Yeah, I mean, after that, you know, we were still doing more reporting, but by the, you know, even after that phone call with Hayden, we kept doing more reporting and more writing and everything. And, but by the time we met with the, you know, we went to New York to meet with the executive editor, Bill Keller, to decide whether to publish it, you know, a week or two before the election. And by that time, Eric Lischblau, the other reporter, and I, and our editor, Rebecca Corbett, believed we should publish the story. And Keller disagreed and decided not to publish it before the election. And based, you know, on the position of the government, which was, you know, they were lobbying the paper very heavily not to publish it on national security grounds. And so I, you know, I disagreed with that decision, and I argued in favor of publication, but Keller decided not to.
How would you characterize, like, Keller's position? Was it that we're getting too much pressure from the United States, or had he, or from the government, or had he bought in, like, this is too dangerous? We're going to expose the United States to, it's too dangerous. We may be exposing the country to a terrorist attack. I mean, in other words, like, what was your sense of his reasoning?
Well, I knew what the government was arguing, you know, government officials. I had met some of them, and we had a meeting right after I called Hayden, the Washington bureau chief, Phil Taubman, and I went to the White House and met with the acting CIA director and his chief of staff. And so I heard their arguments, which were, you know, that this is the, their basic argument was, this is the most important counterterrorism tool that we have. You can't reveal this, the existence of this, to the public, because it'll make it easier for terrorists to attack the United States. And so that was the basic argument. And my position was that terrorists know that the United States listens to their phone, you know, their conversations. And the only thing we were really revealing was that the Bush administration had decided to ignore the law in the way in which they did that. And so I felt like there was a real public right to know that the government was ignoring the law. And so that it was a classic national security versus civil liberties debate. Those are the two opposing positions, basically.
And was it just simply that Keller agreed, like, oh yeah, this is clearly this puts the country too much at risk, or was he like the?
I think he accepted the government's position at that time that this was too valuable a counterterrorism tool, and I think that was the basic view. And you know, it took time over the next, you know, we then, after the election, Eric Lischblau and I convinced the editors to let us try again to get to convince them to publish it. And we did more reporting and more writing. And we then met again with the editors in December 2004, about a month and a half after the election. And again, they decided not to run it, and they decided to kill it. And they still accepted the government's position that it would be too damaging to national security to run it. And I just really disagreed with that decision.
As a reporter in that situation, do you then say, like, well, okay, how about this? How about we don't write what it is? We write there's mm-hmm. a program that's going on that many people have questions as to it being constitutional or legal. Like, I mean, is that a negotiation that you start to make? I mean, Like, I mean, I mean, is that
sometimes you can do that?
Is that a ridiculous idea? I mean, I don't know. Like, that's why, you know,
right?
Is that silly? Like,
no, it's an interesting question. It's an interesting question. There's a lot of stories that are where you negotiate with the government over specific details, in which you agree to take out a certain detail in a story. And I've done that over the years. This was, I never saw how I don't think you could have done that in this case.
Okay.
Because the whole story was about the existence of this program. And, the very existence of the program was the thing they didn't want anybody to know about. It wasn't like some detail they didn't want anybody to know about. And that was, so I think it made it different. But you're right. There are certain stories where a lot of times the news organizations will negotiate. Okay, we'll take this out, and we'll be okay. But I don't think it was possible in this case.
All right. So ultimately, you decide at one point that I'm going to put this in a book because the Times is not going to report it. And that ends up basically forcing their hand. Just walk us through that.
Right. Yeah, well, the backstory to that is that this was like over the previous couple of years, I've had a whole bunch of other stories killed by the paper on the same grounds where the government would say, this, if you run this story, it'll harm national security. So by the time this case happened, I'd heard their arguments about a whole number of stories. And so to me, they were just crying wolf constantly. And so I just decided I wasn't being allowed to cover the war on terror the way I thought it should be covered. And so I decided to write a book and include this story and another story that had been killed by the editors and some other things that I had learned. And so I just decided to put it in a book. And then after I wrote the manuscript and had it, and my publisher had mostly edited it, I told the Times, I'm putting these in my book. You should run the stories.
And
that led to a very whole series of very tense meetings between me and the editors.
I would imagine that they felt like, I mean, it's sort of, but the, I mean, what strikes me about that is like, what happened to their concerns? I mean, obviously they still had some, but the idea that they would get scooped by their own reporter seems to have outweighed their, the concerns that had kept the story out of print for all those years.
Well, actually, what they did was they told me we will reconsider running it, but they wouldn't commit to running the story, the NSA story, even though I told them it was going to be in my book. They just said, I think the way they phrased it was, we will agree to reconsider it and we will reopen negotiations with the government, but if we decide at the end of that process that we still don't think we should run it, we want you to take it out of your book. And that was as far as I could push them. And I said, okay, fine, but I never intended to take it out of my book. And it was too late to do that anyway, so it meant that I was playing a really serious game of chicken with them as they reopened negotiations with the government and decided whether they would publish the story, and my book, the publication date was kind of bearing down. So it was an incredibly stressful time for me.
I would imagine. And we should say, in the other story, or at least one of the major stories that was in State of War, was a story that you had reported about a CIA plan to disrupt the Iranian nuclear program by basically Well, why don't you tell the story of this? Because this is relevant in about three or four different ways to where we are today.
I found out about this story about a year before I found out about the NSA story. And it was basically the CIA had a botched operation, very poorly managed operation, to get a Russian to hand over nuclear blueprints to the Iranians. And these blueprints were supposedly had flaws embedded in them to make sure that, if the Iranians built a nuclear weapon from this, it would be a dud. But the flaws had been put in such a way that they were obvious to the, and so the Russian was very afraid, I think, and sent a letter to the Iranians when he handed over the blueprint that you will see that there are problems with these blueprints. And so this whole idea that they were trying to fool the Iranians kind of got botched. And so I wrote about this harebrained program and wrote a story, and I called the CIA for comment in 2003. And Condoleezza Rice called the Washington bureau chief and demanded that we meet. And I went over to the White House with the bureau chief, and Condoleezza Rice was there along with George Tenet, the CIA director. And Condoleezza Rice stared at me and said, "I want you to destroy your notes, never make another phone call on this story, and forget that you know anything about this." And we left that meeting. It was kind of intimidating, but it was also great confirmation of the story.
Right.
And
weird so authority. I mean, like, under what authority does someone say that to a reporter?
No authority whatsoever. the story had been killed by the Times because the White House, claimed it would damage national security. And then there had been other stories that killed for national security grounds, too. And so by the time the NSA thing happened, I was just felt like I was fed up. And I just felt like I wouldn't respect myself if I kept going along with this stuff.
What's the argument that the story about I guess that was Operation Merlin. The attempt to send bad plans. What's the argument that revelation is going to hurt national security?
Well, they argued that I was wrong when I said that the program was mismanaged. They thought, oh yes, this has been perfectly managed, and we've completely fooled the Iranians. And
okay.
So that was their basic argument. But in fact, several CIA people at the CIA knew that this operation was either a dud or mismanaged. And it was pretty widely known within the agency that this had not worked. But, they don't want to admit things like that.
Well, that seems to be the sort of, that seems to be the big theme with this, right? It's not.
Well, that's what I've learned. That's what the thing I've learned about this whole process of when the government tries to crack down on the press and try to stop the publication of stories. It's almost always just to avoid embarrassment. And yet they use the national security card as a way to convince editors, to put the fear of God into editors,
There was that Thomas Drake thing with Trailblazer. I mean, it always seems to be covering up incompetence is...
Yeah. Or something that's illegal.
Right. Right.
So...
Which is...
I mean, I think one of the things I've told people is I think you go back through history, I don't think you can find a single newspaper story that has ever really damaged national security of the United States. And I think that's what nobody wants to admit, is that the government always makes these claims, And yet there's no proof that national security has ever been harmed by the press.
And in fact, you were, I mean, you were, you were fully prosecuted, but you were more or less, I guess, prosecuted in some regard or under threat of prosecution, not just in the Bush during the Bush administration, specifically because of that Operation Merlin story, but ultimately with the Obama administration. Tell me about that time when you thought, okay, all right, Bush is out of here in, you know, X number of months. So if I can just hang in there until then, I'm surely this is going to end. When did you
right.
realize that was not going to be the case? And tell us about that, because ultimately your source, Jeffrey Sterling, ended up being convicted of violating the Espionage Act.
Well, it's not, I can't discuss whether or not he was a source or not.
Okay. Well,
I'm never going to comment on who was or was not a source for that story.
All right. Fair enough.
What I can say is that in 2008, I was subpoenaed by the Justice Department as part of a leak investigation into my book, State of War. And they focused on the chapter that included the story of Merlin, which the New York Times had never run. And then I fought the subpoena. And as you said, since it began in 2008, I thought, if we can just hang on for a few months, you know, there's an election coming up, and it looked like Obama might win. And so I was hoping that the whole thing would go away. And then the judge in my case kind of let it slow roll it, I think, for the same reason. And then June or July of 2009, after Obama had won, she issued a brief statement saying, well, I see that in this case the grand jury has expired, and that means that the subpoena of Mr. Risen is moot, and I give the government 10 days to decide whether to drop this subpoena or not. And I thought, okay, that was like an open invitation to the Obama administration from a judge to forget about this case and to drop it. And instead, the Justice Department under Obama said, no, we want to continue this case. And we want to, in fact, they said, we want to use the same subpoena that the Bush administration used. And she said, no, you got to get a new subpoena because you have a new attorney general. And so they said, okay. And Eric Holder then issued a new subpoena and started the case, kept the case going, and became even more aggressive. And when she quashed that subpoena that Holder had issued, they issued another one for the trial to test up and force me to testify. And then she quashed that subpoena, and then they appealed her decision to the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals, in arguing that there was the basic argument that they made, which turned this case into a major constitutional showdown, was that there is no such thing as a reporter's privilege in a criminal case. There are, which means, and they spelled this out, a reporter has no more right than any other citizen to avoid testifying. And a reporter has an obligation to testify and reveal sources under in any case that in which we subpoena them. So they were essentially saying the Obama administration's position was that reporters have no rights, no right to protect their sources. And it was shocking to me. And unfortunately, most of the press at that time ignored the case because, you know, hey, well, we can't attack Obama on press freedom. You know, it was like he skated by for a long time until the case went to the Supreme Court. And then the Supreme Court refused to hear my appeal of their ruling in the Fourth Circuit. which the Fourth Circuit sided with the Obama administration. And so the ruling stood, which was reporters like Risen have no rights to protect their sources. And so the only thing I had left was to go to jail or reveal my sources. And so finally, the fact that this went to the Supreme Court started to get more media attention to the case. And that, the one thing I learned about Eric Holder is that he cares about publicity. So he was starting to get bad publicity. So the Obama people started backing off. And at the very end, when I had to go to one pretrial hearing where they asked me, will you reveal your sources? And I said, no. And then they dropped the case, dropped the subpoena against me. And so in the end, they blinked, but they took it so far down the road that the legal legacy of the Obama administration is this Fourth Circuit ruling, which says reporters have no rights to protect their sources. And that still stands today. And it's the Fourth Circuit covers Virginia and Maryland, which includes, which is home to the CIA, the NSA, and the Pentagon. And which means that every major investigation is now covered by a ruling that says you don't have any rights to protect your sources. And so that is something that Donald Trump, I'm sure, will have a field day with.
What do you think? I mean, the Obama administration prosecuted more whistleblowers under the Espionage Act than I think had been done maybe in history combined.
It's more than all previous. More than all previous administrations.
What do you think? I mean, do you have a sense? I mean, there's no reason why you necessarily would, but I'm curious if you have a sense of why. Like, why were, I mean, certainly the expectation that you had, that the judge had, that frankly, if you had asked me, would have had at that time was like, yeah, no, this is not going to be, the Obama administration's not going to be known for being the most aggressive against whistleblowers. No way. Why do you think they were? I mean, what was that?
I have struggled with that question for years, and I don't have a, I mean, I can give you what I think happened.
Sure.
But obviously they didn't tell me. I was like the last person they would talk to about this. But I think it was several factors, and I think probably the most important one was they were afraid of on national security issues. I think Obama was deeply afraid of right-wing attacks on all national security issues. And I think he saw himself as, he saw his biggest priority, it seemed to me, as domestic issues, the economy, healthcare, other issues. And that on national security issues in general, he tended to extend and keep in place most of the policies of the Bush administration. And people don't want to admit that, but that's true. I mean, the one thing he gets credit for was ending the war in Iraq, which he ended it at the same time that the Bush administration planned to end it. And all he did was follow through with the status of forces agreement
right.
that the Bush administration had done. And so I think part of it was part of a larger view of national security policies, which were let's do national security policies in a way that makes it difficult for the right wing to attack us. And I think leak investigations fit into that. And I also think there was also a sense that Obama was never quite as liberal as people thought he was.
Right.
And I think there was a personal, I think on a personal level, he doesn't like the press very much. And then I also think, probably the technology had made it easier to do these kind of leak investigations. And so, you know, you could track people like in, and also you, I think the biggest, probably another factor was you had these mass leaks under Obama. You had WikiLeaks and Edward Snowden. And I think those had played something of a, had a traumatic effect inside the government. And made them more of, have gave them a zero, more of a zero tolerance policy. But none of that excuses the way they dealt with this, because it was anti-democratic and a real and very damaging to press freedom. And I don't think they ever understood what it meant for reporting in America.
Right, the sort of the scarring effect that it would have down the road. I mean, it and do you, I mean, because I my sense is, well, and I, you know, we've on this program talked quite a bit and multiple conversations with Charlie Savage about this over the years, and sort of the Obama mm-hmm. administration's legacy of bringing these programs like this into some type of legal framework, as opposed to, and you know.
Right.
And I think
that's the and Charlie and I, you know, worked together for a long time, and we discussed this between ourselves a lot. And one of the things that Charlie, I think, makes very smart point in his last book was about that the Obama administration saw their primary role as bringing Congress and the courts into agreement with the executive on counterterrorism policy.
Yes.
And that was the main difference between them and the Bush administration, which is, I think he's right. I think that's how they look at it. But that doesn't change the substance of what they were doing.
No, in fact, right? I mean, they were doing... in some ways, it makes the substance, I mean, from the perspective of civil liberties, it makes the substance even worse, because now these things are edified and have, you know, wormed their way into our the construction of our or the fabric of our government. And there's no there's not the same opportunity. There's no recourse here to sort of like reconsider these things or, you know, in the same manner anyways.
No, that's right. That's right. No, I think leak investigations was all part of that. I think they, you know, if you look back, the Obama administration is very secretive and very anti-transparency efforts. And, you know, they went out of their way on a whole range of issues, like Guantanamo, for instance, to, you know, accept the most constrained view of the role of, you know, public dissemination of information.
Do you, in your, you know, in just, I guess, lastly, like, is Trump having sort of the opposite effect? Like, as you do your job now, is Trump on, like, not on purpose, but is he unwinding it? Because I think to a certain extent, there was like, okay, Obama, we can trust him with this stuff. And that's why I think like the mm-hmm. reaction to your case took so long, because people, it mm-hmm. just didn't fit with the narrative. And I think you're right, that the national security state sort of was freaking out about the advances in technology. And I have a feeling that the Obama administration was not only naturally inclined to respond to them, but felt, you know, that it was politically in their best interest to, you know, get out in front, like, oh, we're going to even be more, you know, as you want us than you even imagine how you want us, get out in front of that. But I wonder, is there some type of like backlash under Trump? Are there people who are more almost skittish? I mean, we didn't see it in Congress the other day mm-hmm. when it came to 702 reauthorization.
No, that's the weird thing. I mean, you would think you might be seeing that, but politically you haven't. I mean, I think there's people in the government who are deeply afraid of Trump, but that's one of the surprising things to me, is how little open rebellion you're seeing within the Democratic caucus in towards giving, you know, finding some ways to limit Trump's executive powers. They haven't done it at all about anything.
There didn't seem to be any inclination to do that. I mean, I wonder, In your reporting and just in the course of doing your job, are you seeing a greater sensitivity? Because there seems to be none politically in that sense. Right. But I'm wondering if you're seeing it bureaucratically. Are there people who are questioning internally more than they would have, let's say, under the Obama administration?
Yeah, I think so. But I also think that the crackdown on leaks makes it so a lot of people are, even now, are very afraid of talking. So it's difficult. And I think there's both a fear of Trump and a fear of leak investigations. And so those two things kind of paralyze people, I think, right now.
And lastly, and I promise this is lastly, but and maybe you don't know. I mean, this stuff is fascinating, and your story is really amazing. I mean, just broadly speaking, over the past 10 more years now, I guess. But do you think that there were any lessons learned by, maybe it's, you know, Keller's obviously gone, but do you think institutionally the New York Times or the press at large has changed in any way? I mean, was there any lessons learned that, like, hey, wait a second, we keep seeing this over and over again, where it turns out, like, no, not really about national security, more like people didn't want to get caught screwing up in one fashion or another.
Right.
Do you think there's a greater understanding of that, or no?
I think within the New York Times, I think the fight over the NSA story did have an effect, and I think it helped, you know, I think it was one factor that's helped usher in a new era at the paper, where they're much more aggressive now on national security reporting, at least in some ways. And they're also, the paper is much less willing to agree to hold or kill stories than they used to be. I know that for a fact. And so they're much more skeptical of government arguments to hold or kill stories than they used to be. I think the media writ large on one of the other issues that I talk about in the piece is the debacle of pre-war intelligence on Iraq and WMD reporting and how bad that was. And I don't think the press has learned many lessons from that. I think we still, there's still a lot of hyping of stories on terrorism and WMD. And I think, you know, from Iran or wherever, North Korea, and terrorism, the exaggerated threat of terrorism has made it very difficult politically in Washington for any political leaders to think about dismantling this the growing security state that's been built up since 9/11.
James Risen, the piece in the Intercept is My Life as a New York Times Reporter in the Shadow of the War on Terror. Thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Welcome back, folks. Well, an unchecked national security. I remember when we were arguing about NSA spying, and if you were arguing with some, like, you know, person who's like, I feel totally comfortable with it because Barack Obama is the greatest human being in the history of the universe, and I think it's okay if we drop drones or anywhere, and I don't have anything to hide. And you'd be like, okay, totally, you're right. We should set aside legal process, privacy concerns, human rights, you know, all of that. Totally agree with you. What happens when, you know, Ted Cruz is like, you try to think of the most nutty Republican possible, and then you just know, like, yeah, I Surprise. Mean, what happens when I'm president? You build this whole completely unchecked secret apparatuses, and you throw the keys to me. And now, like, you know, resistance Twitter with that. He's a criminal. But no, we've definitely got to keep the NSA program going for sure. Throw him the keys. It's great stuff. It's good stuff. All right, folks, we're going to go to the fun half. 646-257-3920. 646-257-3920. Become a member of the Majority Report today. Majority.fm/become a member. JustCoffee.coop. Get the Majority Report blend. I believe it's 10% off with the coupon code Majority. Majority Report Kickback, Jet.com. Check out The Michael Brooks Show on iTunes or YouTube or Patreon. Deep Dive History of the Opioid Crisis last night. I'm going to be in LA the next couple of days, so I'll see everybody in either the fun half or on Monday. IMs are on.
All right, folks, 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
Are you ready?
Who sent us this?
Anarchy. Alpha males are back. Back. Boys back. And the alpha males are back.